From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the debate in Detroit over a community benefits ordinance giving neighborhoods a seat at the developer's table.
This particular ordinance is very vague and confusing.
We have no say about our public health, around noise barriers, around issues around our quality of life, blight in the community.
The frustrated mother of a dyslexic child wonders why.
The public school seems to not want to use the word dyslexia.
And a tiny UP town copes with growing throngs of tourists to Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore.
How do we accommodate with the hospitality that people have become accustomed to in Munising, this large number of visitors, while at the same time maintaining our quality of life?
Those stories and more. Are schools doing enough to help dyslexic students?
The public school seems to not want to use the word dyslexia.
Our dyslexic children need intensive, explicit, systematic intervention.
I'm Cynthia Canty. We'll talk about what those students need to succeed and whether Michigan schools are meeting the needs of these dyslexic students. That's later this hour. But first, a petition drive to put a proposed Detroit City ordinance on the ballot is running into opposition. This proposed ordinance concerns community benefits agreements. It would require new large developments using public money or land in Detroit to return some benefits to surrounding neighborhoods. Benefits could range from employment preference for neighborhood residents to health and safety measures. Earlier today, representatives of unions, along with some local residents and workers, held a press conference asking city officials to reject this agreement. With us is Mike Jackson with the Michigan Regional Council of Carpenters and Millwrights, where he's executive secretary treasurer. Mike, why do you believe the CBA is a jobs killer?
Well, this particular ordinance is very vague and confusing. If you read it, it says that a developer has to sit down with a host committee, which is a community group, but it doesn't give specifics as to which community groups they'd sit down with. It doesn't give any parameters as to exactly how those negotiations would go or what the limits are. It doesn't give any timelines. When we speak to the development community, if they're given the option of going to a community where they can lock those details down and not have to sit down and negotiate with an unknown group that has a totally open door to what they could negotiate for, they will choose to go outside of the city of Detroit, which will keep those jobs from coming to Detroit.
Do you think that the problem you see is in the way that this proposed ordinance is worded, or is it this idea of community benefits and letting people from the community have a seat at the table?
There is nothing wrong with community benefits agreement. As an organization, we support the concept. It is this particular ordinance and the way it's written. I think the people that first drafted this had everybody's best interests in mind, probably had the right intentions in mind. It aims for community involvement, but it doesn't offer clear definition even of who the community is or exactly what that involvement means. It has some pretty complicated goals, but again, it doesn't have any timelines or processes in place to achieve those goals. It's this particular community benefits agreement that we take exception to. We've supported community benefits agreements in the past. We will continue to in the future. And most of the development that's in Detroit today, the city council and the mayor's office have negotiated certain community benefits into those development agreements. You know, there are hiring preferences for the new stadium and other developments. The combined building trades in Detroit have started a program called Access for All that's designed just for Detroit City residents. And it's a 9-week program to get them up to speed to join our apprentices and get them onto those projects. Those all make sense, and developers understand them coming in the door, what those mean. It's when you put these unknowns on the table that developers have a choice. You know, usually most developers are looking at several different places that they could put a development. And if you add this additional unknown, the way this ordinance is written, we're convinced that a lot of developments will choose to go outside the city of Detroit.
Mike Jackson is with the Michigan Regional Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Mike, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to former State Representative Rashida Tlaib. She's one of the leaders in the campaign to get this community benefits ordinance on the November ballot. So we just heard Mike Jackson of the Michigan Regional Council of Carpenters and Millwrights say to us they're not against community benefits. It's this particular ordinance they oppose because they think it's too vague. What's your response?
Well, you know, we have been working with Council President Jones for over 4 years. It's been at council for 2 years. Everyone is open to having a conversation of how to make the ordinance better, if that is the issue. However, I do think some of the approach and intention of labor leaders has been disingenuous in regards to this. We do believe there needs to be a legally binding agreement when it comes to community benefits agreements when there is a $300,000 or more tax abatement, tax break, public subsidies. We've seen time and time again various developments happening, but our neighborhood's still looking the same. And we, you know, welcome any labor organizations to come to the table. I mean, what we heard today at council was a carpenter who said, someone like me that looks like me, who is an African-American male, is not at the stadium construction site. He's not at various other construction sites that are developments based on our tax dollars. And so we told him the ordinance gets you to the table. It gets us to have a conversation with these developers. So we welcome the conversation to happen, and we haven't been hiding the ordinance. I mean, it's been introduced 2 years ago. It's been there. And I know Council President Jones welcomes any feedback, any discussion about changes. But we were pushed to put it on the ballot because, you know, we've been waiting for a vote from council members or even a thoughtful conversation about it.
Let's talk about how this might work. So when a developer is at the point of the process when it is time to ask the public for something, a tax break, a zoning variance, whatever it may be, under this proposed community benefits ordinance, how would the host community be notified?
It has to be a $15 million project with $300,000 in public subsidies. And so the council district rep, say it's District 6, it would be Councilwoman Raquel Castaneda Lopez, that would be engaging the community and organizing the community to start having a conversation with the developer about the project.
And then what? I mean, how would you decide who is the one from the community to lead negotiations exactly?
We have census tracts that we use in the agreement. What we see across the country is that many of these neighborhoods are already organized with various coalitions. I mean, you have the Pittsburgh Penguins had the One Hill Coalition that came together, and it's, you know, hundreds of block clubs that came together that were impacted by the Pittsburgh Penguins stadium development. And they sat down and came up with a community benefits agreement that was signed. They have legal standing in court to hold that developer accountable. This is a development that got, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars in tax abatement and various other resources from the city of Pittsburgh. And so we've learned from them. We've learned from the expansion of Los Angeles Airport, where many of the community organizations, again, came together around this issue. The burden is on the community to be organized. And if we're not, then they can go to the council and get a waiver and say, look, there is no community organization that we can negotiate with, or there's all these other issues. A lot of it just still puts the burden on the community and allows the city council representative to take the lead on this, and they can help direct these negotiations. The problem now is we don't have a seat at the table. A lot of this is happening behind closed doors, and our tax dollars are at use here, and we have no say about our public health, around noise barriers, around, you know, issues around our quality of life, you know, blight in the community. These are things that we want to talk about because our tax dollars would have been used towards those resources, but for that development.
Rashida, how transparent, let's say a representative of the community is at the table, how transparent and public would all of this be? Because is it not important for, especially some of these big projects, to even get them off the ground? They need to be kind of put together quietly and more privately.
Absolutely. There is a lot of transparency here. You know, a lot of these developments are taking years to put together. The problem is we don't know about it until we actually have to be forced to be notified. In this case, I mean, we would be part of the process from the beginning. The other issue is, you know, raising the standard. Right now, we have so much development going on, many of which would not even qualify for a community benefits process under the ordinance language. But many that do, they have been moving forward without considering the various families and communities that are directly impacted by the development. And we have seen over and over again that it just doesn't work anymore. And I think Council President Jones and some other community leaders have seen how it has you know, backfired on us. Not only the Marathon Oil Refinery, who got $175 million in exchange for 100 jobs, and they only gave us 15 jobs, which is about $11 million per job. That was the only thing we really pushed and asked for. And we still are not able to hold them accountable to that. Look, if you're a developer and you're not getting in the line of taking, you know, land for almost for free or getting these big tax breaks, then you're not going to be, you know, required to have this community benefits process be part of your development plan.
Rashida, there are some who would say more layers of involvement and more processes to go through. That opens up more opportunities for corruption. We certainly saw that, for example, during the Kilpatrick administration. Is that a fair criticism?
Well, it isn't, because when the community is involved, these are the people that are putting forward their own tax dollars towards the development. These are people that are not saying no to development. Yes, but we would like to be part of the conversation. Honestly, currently, the Flexing Gate, the what's going on at the state fairgrounds with Magic Johnson's development, all of that is being discussed behind closed doors. That, to me, leads to more corruption than actually having public meetings with people that are going to be directly impacted by the project. This actually helps prevent the kind of corruption that we've seen in the past. Right now, too many residents are asking too many questions about these developments, including the Magic Johnson development that's supposedly happening in state fairgrounds. A lot of people are not asking enough questions about what's going on there. And then the Flexing Gate. Again, a lot of these developments, plans and agreements and so forth, are happening behind closed doors right now. And with the community benefits process, I truly believe it raises the standard and allows it to be much more transparent.
Rashida Tlaib, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Upper Peninsula communities around the Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore are finding themselves right in the tourism bullseye. More and more visitors are making their way to Pictured Rocks these days, some 723,000 last year alone, according to the National Park Service, which tells us the number could hit 1 million this year. That's a whole lot of people swarming into the small towns that flank Pictured Rocks. Towns like Munising, population somewhere around 2,300. Let's see what all of this tourist activity has meant for Munising as we welcome its mayor, Rod Desjardins. Rod, that 37% increase in visitors to Pictured Rocks last year, what did that mean to Munising in terms of money spent in your town?
Well, according to the Federal Park Service figures, that was about a $25 million impact last year. You know, I'm not entirely sure how they measure that, but it is a significant economic driver in our community.
I would imagine there are a lot of mayors and town officials around the state that would love to be able to make that claim for their own towns.
I would think so. I mean, we have always been a tourist town, but over the last 5 years, the number of visitors coming to Picture Rocks, which is the central attraction, has seen double-digit increases for 5 years in a row, and then 37% last year. And already this summer, we're looking at probably a same volume or increase, or a 30 to 40% increase over last year.
And what's fueling this boom in interest in Pictured Rocks?
Well, you can blame it on Kid Rock, you can blame it on Ginger Z, you can blame it on Pure Michigan, or you can blame it on an ad campaign by Pictured Rocks Cruises, which is our central tourist business. Everybody's seen the Kid Rock video, Born Free, that was filmed at Miners Beach, and Ginger Z, of course, did that Good Morning America mm-hmm. piece this spring. And if you look at the Pure Michigan ads, half of the video in all the Pure Michigan ads is shot right here in Alger County, Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore and Grand Island National Recreation Area. Free advertising, Cindy.
It's free advertising, and when with that probably comes a mixed blessing. So I'm wondering, how has this tourist buzz changed life in Munising, for better and for worse?
Well, in the summertime, we have a saying, you never try to make a left turn onto the highway, because you can't. So the traffic is the one thing that people lament the most, the volume of traffic on M28, which goes right through the center of town. But last year, we were sort of, and I'll be honest, we were sort of taken aback by the increase. We just weren't ready for it. And we struggled to accommodate the huge number of visitors who came here for the same reason that we live here, which is, you know, this is God's country and an outdoor paradise. And over the winter, we have regrouped as a municipality and as a business community, and we are well prepared for this summer. And in fact, We're looking at, for a small town, 15 new businesses opening just to accommodate the summer tourist trade.
I've got to wonder about finding workers for, you know, hotels and restaurants for these businesses and that have been most greatly impacted. And we just learned that the Homestead Resort in Leelanau County had to shut a restaurant and cancel the summer kids camp. They held a hiring fair and nobody showed up. Are you seeing some of the same challenges, or are people able to find enough workers for their businesses?
Well, this year so far we have. If you want to work and you don't mind living in rustic conditions, because housing is really a problem, well, not a problem, I mean it's scarce, there's plenty of work in Munising. And what we have done is we have reached out to surrounding communities. I know that one of our local kayak operators brings in all of his employees from Marquette. We have a large seasonal workforce with the Park Service and the Forest Service anyway, which strains our ability to accommodate any sort of guest worker, whether they're college kids or high school kids or immigrant workers.
I have to wonder what you hear from people in your town about all this extra love and extra spending from visitors. Are there times that you hear it from people where they look wistfully back at less busy and less hectic summers?
You know, mostly the older folks. I get the longing for the good old days when, you know, there was no congestion and we didn't have to share this place with anybody. But quite frankly, the business community has embraced the uptick in customers. And personally, I enjoy sharing and showing people why we live where we live. We are literally in the middle of the Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, the Grand Island National Recreation Area, two state forests, the Hiawatha National Forest, the Seney Wildlife Refuge, four wilderness areas within 20 miles of downtown, and tens of thousands of acres of commercial forest reserve that's open for recreation. So this is an outdoor person's paradise, regardless of whether they like fishing or hiking or canoeing or boating or hunting or ice climbing.
And so I'm pretty sure I'm hearing you say it is possible for Munising to strike a balance, to maintain that quality of life that brings you there and keeps you there, but also embrace this extra economic activity?
Well, over the winter, we addressed several areas. The park, of course, had to address congestion in the park and on the waters of the park, and we've done that successfully. That was a problem last year. It's not a problem this year. And then we have a group that's meeting to try and improve our housing stock so that we have more seasonal rentals. Now, of course, seasonal rentals, you look at issues like zoning, and you want seasonal rentals in what were traditional R1 neighborhoods. We have another group that's looking at just at our infrastructure. Last year, we had this problem with garbage cans in the park. Got filled up just like three times a day, so we had to put on extra staff just to empty garbage cans. The fourth group is employment, and our Chamber of Commerce is working on that. We had Michigan Works come in and talk to folks about the realities of guest workers. And then the fifth group is the most important group, which is just coming together, and that is a quality of life group. How do we accommodate with the hospitality that people have become accustomed to in Munising, this large number of visitors, while at the same time maintaining our quality of life? Our Mayberry side, if you will, which we are very proud of, and it's why we live where we live.
And I think what you're dealing with, other towns around Michigan, I know we've had conversations with officials in Traverse City facing many of the same kinds of issues. Do you all share notes at times? Is there a chance to kind of see what might work in one part of Michigan or share ideas?
Well, we get to learn from the mistakes or the growing pains of other communities. One thing, if you do a Google Earth search of Munising and you look at the geography here, we will never grow to the extent of Traverse City because there physically is not enough room to do that. And 80% of Alger County is public land, so we will always be condensed and a small community. And so it's a unique challenge for us because the visitors will keep coming and we have to accommodate them on a much smaller public and private footprint.
Rod Desjardins is the mayor of the Alger County town of Munising, giving us a sense of what life is like in this town of 2,300 people with all of these thousands of people coming to see the Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore. It was great to talk with you, Mayor. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Writer Shannon Gibney tackles some very sensitive and very emotional subjects in her new young adult novel, See No Color. First, she speaks to us through the voice of a teenage girl, and that alone can present a merry-go-round of turbulent emotions. Next, that teen, named Alexander Kurtridge, is an adoptee. And layered over all of that is the fact Alex is biracial, adopted by white parents as a very young child. It's a sensitively written story, taking readers through all kinds of questions of family, race, identity, and self-discovery. Shannon Gibney is a writer, activist, and educator. She grew up in Michigan and now lives in Minneapolis with her husband and children. See No Color recently won a Minnesota Book Award for Young Adult Literature. Welcome, and I guess we say welcome home to Ann Arbor. You went to community high school in Ann Arbor?
I did. I loved it, yes. Growing up in Ann Arbor was amazing. It's a cliche to say so, but it's a great place to grow up.
Tell me about your central character, Alex Kurtridge, and what you're able to say to us through telling her story.
Yeah, no, I was just trying to, as you said, I love the way that you introduced the book. You know, it's a very layered narrative, definitely in the voice of this 16-year-old mixed black girl who's adopted into this white family in this moment when her identity is really starting to change. You know, her adopted father is this amazing baseball player. He has played with the Milwaukee Brewers, and he has been training Alex and her younger brother, Jason, to be these great baseball players ever since they were very young. And as the story progresses, in this moment, we see that Alex's body is changing, her balance is off at the plate, and then she comes to find that her adoptive parents have also been keeping letters from her black biological parent, her father, from her. And so that just sort of all these questions about identity start percolating, and where do I fit in this family, and who am I? And it sort of starts her on this journey.
And in what ways is Alex beginning to become more and more aware that her skin color is not like her family's, or who helps her to that realization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Alex, she's always known in some sense that she is different than the rest of her family. And I think, you know, with the title See No Color, it's like, you know, she's growing up in this family, in this environment that has really embraced this colorblind narrative. And I mean, there's definitely parts of that idea that are very good. That idea of sort of like, oh, we're all just people. But then as she becomes, starts coming into herself as her own discrete person, we start to see some of the problems with that, that the rest of the world, and even before that, you know, I'm going to read a section when she's about eight, right, at they're at a cabin with the rest of the family, and an older white lady comes up to her and her family and is like, her mother, and is just like, what gives? Why do you have this black child with you? And so you start to see that even though, you know, the cracks in this idea that, you know, we're all just human, we don't see color. No, actually, people do see color. But one of the main arguments, I think, is that, you know, when you do that as a parent, at a certain point, the kid is the one that has to actually field and figure out.
Where do I fit?
Yeah. And that's a really hard thing to put on a child.
Would you read that excerpt for us?
I will. Thank you.
This is Shannon Gibney reading from her new young adult novel, See No Color.
I want to stay at the lake cottage always, where it is shimmery and air open everywhere. I know Mom wants to, too. But we always have to go home at the end of the week, because school will start again. I am trying to blow bubbles from my nose, and the sun is pushing the sky down when she shakes my arm. At first, I think I am drowning, like Mom told me to be careful of, that someone is dragging me under. It is not too deep here, but I forget that I have feet and legs, too, so I kick and squirm, and water comes into my eyes and nose. I am coughing and also sinking, but then the lady from the cottage next door pulls me up out of the heavy water, both of her arms grabbing my shoulders. You're boating the mar from your most family, she says, and she is squiggly and kind of melting. I laugh. She frowns. Your host family, she says again. You need to get back to them. I try to smile at her to make her not mad, but the smile falls out of my mouth too quick. The old lady sticks her face in mine. Do you speak English? Where are you from? Can you understand me? She looks like a witch from the Halloween book who has lost her hat, so I laugh again. I don't know if they swim where you're from, but here children need to swim close to the shore. It's dangerous. You should be careful. The laughing stops. There is that word again, careful. I was not being careful, like Mom said. I try to back up toward the shore, away from the lady witch who smells like garlic. Then Mom is beside me, wading into the lake, all towel and top of head kisses. What seems to be the problem? Looking to mom to me, no words come from the lady, but she is still speaking with her eyes. Was my daughter bothering you somehow? How is she your daughter? Mom's face is empty, nothing there at all except her eyes blinking. She's your host daughter then, from Africa? Mom's eyes explode. What are you talking about? That's my daughter, Alex. But she's black, the lady says. She spits it out. Black, like a bug in her mouth. Black, 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 black. I say it over and over in my mouth and later that night in my bed. I am black, 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 black. She's adopted, Mom says, pulling me into her side. Not that it's any of your business. She turns us around and we are walking back to our part of the beach, the waves turning darker. I see my hand now beside hers, and for the first time, it is brown. Hers is not. Hers is light. I am brown and they are light. Listen to me, Alex, she is saying. That woman doesn't know what she's talking about, okay? She's just crazy. I move my head up and down because she wants it. We are all one in this family, okay? We don't even see color.
Shannon Gibney reading for her new young adult novel, See No Color. I deliberately didn't do a lot of digging around about your background because I wanted to just open the book and read it. But I'm an adoptee who finally met her birth mother. And I have to say, you did an amazingly authentic job of capturing that awkwardness in the meeting and the power of seeing a face that actually echoes your own. Are you an adoptee?
I am an adoptee, and I am a transracial adoptee.
There you go. So on top of that betwixt and between feeling that we adoptees have, then you have this issue of race layered over it. Has awareness of the challenges of transracial adoptions changed, do you think, since you were a child?
Yes.
How?
And that's largely because of, I would say, adoptee activism, adoptees sharing our story and kind of demanding that this binary between, you know, the good, happy, adjusted adoptee and the, you know, angry, maladjusted adoptee gets busted open, right? The reality, like all realities, is that it's much more complicated than that. And that's the reality that I'm trying to show. And also, I hope that, you know, you might not be a transracial adoptee mm-hmm. yourself, but, you know, a lot of us do, I think you point to a good point, yearn for that connection and that ability to see some part of ourselves in another face, right? That sort of physical, even emotional connection. Alex finds out later too that, you know, she hiccups when she's anxious, and her birth father, it turns out, he hiccups too. And members of his family do so as well, right?
And suddenly there's chord is struck. When I met my birth mother, I realized she had the same short hair that I've always wanted to wear, that I've always wanted my entire life. I always wanted it. And when I saw that haircut, and I just went in my, I had that same chord, that same feeling.
Right. And it's just so hard to express. Yeah. And at the same time, though, I hope in that scene where, you know, she actually meets her birth mm-hmm. father and his family, that also, you know, adoptees, too, we have this idea. And a lot of it, again, is because a lot of the scholarship, a lot of the existing literature is not by adoptees, right? That the experiences of reunion and stuff like that get very flattened. And they're actually quite layered, right? So at that same moment where she's meeting her birth father and she does have these certain connections, it's also very strange. It's like, this is my father, but he's not my father. Let's be clear. I don't know him. He doesn't know me, right? And mm-hmm. so it's all those things at once.
You did a beautiful, beautiful job of it. And I would suggest that anyone with adoption in their life, anyone in that birth triad, even though this is a young adult novel, will benefit from reading your novel, See No Color, because of the insight it brings. It's a good read. And we want to let you know that Shannon Gibney will be at Nicola's Books in Ann Arbor tomorrow night, July 6th at 7 p.m., talking about the book, signing the book, See No Color. Shannon, it was great talking with you. I love the book. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Motown legend Smokey Robinson received a very special honor today from the Library of Congress. He will be awarded this year's Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, celebrating lifetime achievement in pop music. Robinson performed and wrote some of Motown's greatest hits, from Tracks of My Tears, I Second That Emotion, The Tears of a Clown. He also wrote huge hit songs for other artists like The Temptations, Shop Around, My Girl, and Get Ready, and hits for Mary Wells like Two Lovers and My Guy. Previous winners of the Gershwin Award include Motown's Stevie Wonder, as well as Paul McCartney, Willie Nelson, and Billy Joel. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
People say I'm the life of the party. joke or two. Although I might be laughing loud and hearty, deep inside.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. By the time they leave kindergarten, kids are supposed to have learned the building blocks of literacy. They should be able to connect letters to sounds and spell simple words like cat and book. But for the estimated 1 in 5 children with dyslexia, those basic skills aren't so easy to master. Without extra help, dyslexic children can face a lifetime of learning difficulties. And many parents and advocates say that Michigan schools are not equipped to provide the kind of extra help these dyslexic students really need. Carolyn Kaganov is one of those parents. Her son, Evan, just finished first grade in the Ann Arbor Public School System and was diagnosed with severe dyslexia. Also with us is speech pathologist Dr. Joanne Pearson. She's a founding partner of the Literacy, Language, and Learning Institute based in Ann Arbor. She's also the project manager for the University of Michigan's Dyslexia Help Project. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for listening to our story.
Well, Carolyn, I want to start with you. Evan was diagnosed with dyslexia as a first grader.
In January of 2016, he was diagnosed with dyslexia, dysgraphia, and dyscalculia, which is basically a learning disability in reading, writing, and math. He was diagnosed as having severe.
During his first grade. When did you begin to sense that things were not as they should be in the learning process for Evan?
I kind of always knew. He had speech problem when he was young, which is very common for children with dyslexia. But everyone was like, oh, people learn at different rates. And then he was in kindergarten and he just hated it. And I have an 11-year-old who went through the public school system. And it just, I could see the difference. And then he hated it so much and he was so behind that we discussed and we retained him. So he actually did kindergarten in the public school system twice. Our next year in public school, it went fine. And my goal for him was really that he just enjoy school. And it's a place that children have to go to for a very long time. And you don't want them to, you know,
to dread it. Yes.
That's not what you want. You want them to really embrace learning because they have to do it for a very long time. They do it forever, you know? So his second year in kindergarten went really well. Actually, he came out on target at the end of that year for everything. And then over the summer, because I still felt like
things
were not sure.
Right.
I'm just not sure, right? Mm. So I sent him to a tutoring program. And then he went to first grade. And 10 days into first grade, the teacher, who is phenomenal, calls me and says, Caroline, we have to talk. We have a problem. And before I even got there, I knew what the problem was. Mm. And actually, the public school system did evaluation of Evan. And they came back to me and said, you know, Evan is just low across the board and there's nothing we can do. Apparently, there's this rule in special ed, which obviously I know nothing about special ed at this stage, that if you're low across the board, then that's just your expectation, not my child is reading in the first percentile and there's something we need to do about this. Just, it's low across the board. And I said, you know what?
Which means we're dialing back the expectations.
Exactly.
Joanne, you're nodding, mm-hmm. so you've heard this mm-hmm. before.
Mm-hmm. So I was like, no, you're missing what I see. I see this bright, smart child mm-hmm. who has an amazing vocabulary, who can tell when people are sad. He has such empathy for other people around him. And he's curious. And he is an amazing problem solver. And I'm like, you're missing this. So they did tell me, you know, he has some attention issues. And I was like, those attention issues are related to the academic side of things. Because at home, he doesn't have those attention issues. So I asked for an independent evaluation.
And that's the one where you got the diagnosis.
And that is the one where I got the diagnosis.
So when you circled back to the school with that diagnosis, what happened?
Well, before I got that diagnosis, I did a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, to the special ed teacher, I think my child has dyslexia. And I got an answer I wasn't expecting. Lots of children in the school system have dyslexia. And there's nothing we do for children with dyslexia. And I was like, no, that can't be right, you know? Mm-hmm. So by the time it came time for me to have an IEP meeting, which is an individualized education plan, I was already apprehensive about this. And I don't know if you've ever been to an IEP meeting. It's very intimidating for a parent. You go in there, at my IEP meeting, including me, there were 9 people. Those people around the table,
six of them I didn't even really know, you know.
All from the school.
Yeah, and they're telling you things, and your goal is to come out of there with a plan to ensure your child achieves literacy.
So you came away with an IEP. Were you satisfied with this?
During the IEP process, I found something that actually is very prevalent during all IEP processes with children with dyslexia, is the public school seems to not want to use the word dyslexia. And this is not my opinion. This is a fact, because Michael Uden, who is the Assistant Secretary of the Department of Education for the United States, wrote a letter because he needed to bridge the gap between parents and public schools so that everyone knew it's okay to use this word. And I was told, we don't use that label. We treat to the child's individual needs and go from there, which makes total sense, except if you have dyslexia, because mm-hmm. you need to know that, because otherwise you can't say I'm dyslexic, and that's not an intelligence issue. It's a learning difference.
All right. And with that, I want to turn to Joanne Pearson as a speech pathologist, partner manager with University of Michigan's Dyslexia Help Project. And I think a lot of people, Joanne, think dyslexia means reading words backwards. But that doesn't begin to cover what this means. So give us a sense of what dyslexia actually looks like.
And that is very true. Many people think of it as reversing letters, which is not dyslexia at all. Many children reverse letters as they're learning to read. Dyslexia is a language-based learning disorder. And these children have difficulties perceiving the sounds in our language. So the word cat, we'll keep it very plain, mm-hmm. cat, they may not be able to parse out those sounds. This is in the absence of seeing any letters, just to hear cat and know it is made up of a k. At. So they have difficulty taking words apart and putting words back together. That is one of the bottom defining characteristics, one of the key defining characteristics of dyslexia. They also may have problems with rapid automatic naming, pulling up words and symbols quickly. When we were talking about preschool children, these kids may have difficulty saying words. I recently assessed a little guy who was looking at these pictures, and the test was getting really hard. And he looked at me and he said, how am I getting all of these? I'm instructable. He meant indestructible. His dyslexic brain had heard those words and dropped out a syllable. So we frequently will see that. Then these kids will have problems, one, with the sounds of our language, and then you have to learn how to map those sounds onto the letters of our language. So you take a word like cat, it's pretty straightforward, k, at, three sounds, three letters. You take a word like sleigh, as in the sleigh you ride in, you've still got three sounds, three phonemes, as we say, s-l-a, but all of a sudden you have six letters for three sounds. So then that's another level that we need to get at. And these kids then can have difficulties with reading comprehension, writing. If they have difficulty with verbal expression, that's going to cause problems with writing, phonological memory, remembering sounds and words, that can affect them in both reading and writing.
So looking down the road with these students,
yes.
Let's say they don't get the kind of extra and special help they need. What kind of impact can that have on their learning through the rest of their life?
Well, first of all, across the curriculum. So we may see kids who are at Caroline's son's level, first grade, who have difficulty just accessing the words, right? They mm-hmm. cannot learn to decode the words. You have a lot of kids who are dyslexic, but they get through those early years because there's so much support by the teacher, and at that time you are learning to read. We also see a peak, so to speak, a spike at the fourth grade level. We call it the fourth grade slump, because now all of a sudden you have to know how to decode. You have to know how to read. You are now required to use your reading to learn. If you cannot access the same text that your peers are accessing, you cannot develop the vocabulary. You're not exposed to the same vocabulary
as
your peers.
You're not succeeding academically.
Exactly. And then we can see it again, say, middle school, when the demands become even more difficult, high school, on through life, and it can affect people in the workforce. And I think Caroline made a good point that the word dyslexia is very important. I start talking with my peewees about dyslexia and that you have dyslexia, because it helps them understand what is going on with them.
And that it's not their fault and it's not a character thing.
Exactly. And it's not an intellect
issue. All of the above. Now, when a student in public school, Joanna, is diagnosed with dyslexia, as Caroline's son Evan was, what are schools supposed to be doing?
Dyslexia falls under the Michigan Administrative Rules for Special Education, the MARS rules, under specific learning disability. The word is there in the code. Mm-hmm. With all students who are in special education, they design an individual educational plan.
The IEP.
That is exactly, the IEP, that is designed around their strengths and their weaknesses. And then goals and objectives are developed, to be developed, toward those weak areas. And then the student gets the necessary intervention specific to their needs.
So here we hear Carolyn's story that they didn't want to use that word dyslexia. Why do you think that is? Why would a school be reluctant to put that word into the child's IEP?
Well, historically, this is back in the day, so to speak, dyslexia was seen as a medical diagnosis, whereas we are now in an educational system, right? And there was a bifurcation of that kind of, you know, the medical diagnosis versus educational. We need to look at it that dyslexia is an inability to learn to read, spell, and write. It's the job of our schools to teach kids to read, spell, and write. And so I think we've had this historical way of being. And there are some school districts. I've worked with a couple of school districts who are getting on board with this relative to getting their teachers the training to meet the needs of these kids. And it goes back to, you know, teaching our teachers in the teacher education programs. It's at a policy level in Lansing. It's sort of pervasive across the board.
I have to ask, and whichever of you wants to tackle this, is there a cost issue? Does it cost a district more if that dyslexia term is used and other interventions are needed versus, oh, well, it's ADHD and perhaps prescriptions and medication is the answer?
Well, ADHD is not under the Special Education Code of Michigan, for one thing. But relative to the cost, this is a child with a specific learning disability. The costs are there whether you identify the child with an SLD, specific learning disability, in basic reading or reading comprehension versus whether you call the child dyslexia.
That was Joanne Pearson speaking, speech pathologist. We're also here with Carolyn Kaganov, whose son Evan just wrapped up first grade in public school in Ann Arbor and during that year was diagnosed with severe dyslexia. What were your biggest frustrations during this whole process, Caroline?
Since I'm, you know, on the other side of it, my biggest frustration is that I know my child will achieve literacy because I will ensure that my child achieves literacy. And I really worry about the fact that 1 in 5 children have some form of dyslexia. Mm-hmm. Here I am, and I'm like, no, these are requirements. This is not an option. Literacy is not an option for any child.
And did you feel that was the school's position? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of
I honestly feel like they want to help. Yeah. I feel like they do want to help, but I feel like they don't know how to help. Their hands are somewhat tied. So the identification process is a problem because I'm astute enough to say, I want my child to have an IEA. If I just stopped at their evaluation, then I have a child whose his level is down here and that's it, you know? Mm-hmm. And there were barriers. Like I made that appointment and to make that appointment, I had to give them my credit card. Not everybody has a credit card. You get a piece of paper that says, you know, you'll be responsible for these charges if it's a case that comes back the same outcome as me. Well, what happens to the parent who doesn't have $2,500 to ensure that this happens? So right there, I worry. I worry about the identification of these children. According to Every Student Succeeds Act, it says that we have to use evidence-based screening assessments for early identification, and this was about dyslexia, not later than kindergarten. It says not later. That's federally mandated, okay? And that didn't happen in a very, very good public school system.
Now tell us, Evan's getting outside assistance. How are things with Evan now getting ready for second grade?
We went to outside intervention. We sent him 2 hours a day before school, 4 days a week, and 3 hours at the weekend for one-on-one intervention. Mm-hmm. That intervention was not cheap. It was $18,000 for 18 weeks.
And going right back to the fact that how many people could afford that?
Cindy, mm-hmm. I have to be honest. You know what my child learned out of that? The alphabet. He's really good at the alphabet now. He learned how to decode words in a way that he can look at a word and go, cat, cat. If he's reading the word cat on every single page, he has to say cat, mm-hmm. cat. So it's hard for me because I know that the law says my child is entitled to a free and appropriate public education, right? And I feel like although everybody wanted to help my child, that my child didn't get. There was nothing free about mm-hmm. sending him mm-hmm. to learn the mm-hmm. alphabet. If it was really appropriate, I feel like I would have had a plan that entailed his strengths. And I was told during the IEP meeting at the top when we were doing his strengths, and I could talk about my child's strengths all day long. You know, we don't want to highlight those things because it's an IEP. We want to work on the weaknesses. But my child, his brain doesn't function like everyone else's.
You know your child. And one of the things about dyslexia is that, you know, here we've got a preschooler who's pretty much cooking along. They may have speech and language problems, but they're making friends. They're having a good mm-hmm. time. They can build
socializing.
The most, yes, they yeah. can build the most amazing Lego structure or lead you through the most amazing interactive, imaginative game. And then all of a sudden they send their child to school and this is not the kid they know. I think believe in that and then understand on Dyslexia Help, I have how to walk through the special education system. So to understand that you as a parent have a right to make a request for a special education referral. And you can go and talk to the people in your special education office. Every public school district has one. And then you're going to have to get knowledgeable. And one of the books I recommend is Sally Shaywitz's Overcoming Dyslexia. Dr. Shaywitz published this book in 2003, and she wrote it for parents. And it still remains current as to what we know about diagnosing dyslexia and then what we know about how to treat dyslexia.
I think we'll have to leave it there, but it's certainly a lesson that people can learn from your experience, Carolyn, with your son, Evan. Carolyn Kaganoff, parent of a dyslexic child, and speech pathologist, Dr. Joanne Pearson, who's a founding partner of the Literacy, Language, and Learning Institute based in Ann Arbor and the project manager for the University of Michigan's Dyslexia Help Project. Can people turn to this Dyslexia Help Project?
Absolutely. This is a private-funded project at the University of Michigan that they can find dyslexiahelp.umich.edu.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Joanne.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And Carolyn, thank you for sharing Evan's story.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's show was engineered by Rusty Brock. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.